And we're off. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. How you doing? I wanted to make a couple of short videos today on some subjects that have come up, as they do regularly in discussions on the practice of Buddhism. This first one I want to focus on a couple of words, but words in general. So I'm going to make this early reiteration to those of us who really like to study. There's a tendency in study to chase down the meaning of words, which isn't itself a bad thing. It helps us understand deeper concepts and leads to greater understanding and insights in the meaning of the sermons, the sutra, the commentaries, so forth. But it's also very easy to get trapped in the I'll find the solution when I understand this word. And you know, Shakyamuni, 2700 years ago or so, repeatedly cautioned his students to not get hung up on the words. Don't just try to dissect every single word and grammatical inference made in my sermons. Try instead to use your understanding of the words to gain deeper understanding of the meaning of what I'm talking about, what I'm saying, what those words are formulating pictures of, understandings of, insights of. Get to that. If I could use a more contemporary examples, I would say, again, I'll use the math analogy. When we learn mathematics, when we first start learning adding and subtracting fractions, for instance, we learn this method that stays with us for years of cancellation. When you have a one here and a one there, you cancel them out, slide those things over, and blah, voila, you have the answer. It's kind of magical, but you don't stop to think of it as mathematical. You take it as a mathematical rule, if you will. It's not until later, maybe not until algebra, that you're finally taught what's really going on there. And it's not a cancellation. It's there's a means extremes property, I seem to remember, and it might have been in geometry, but it's more evolved mathematics than that early addition and subtraction, where it shows you what those numbers actually mean. For instance, a 2/2 is actually 1, because if you have both halves of something, you have the whole thing, 1. But that's not explored in those early maths. So that's why it's important to not just take for granted the words that are said or written, but at the same time, to get hung up on those words as though they are the answer can be very misleading. You need to understand what's actually going on, what the meaning of things are. Okay, so because it comes up a lot, and I've talked about them before, but I'm going to address them now because it's been quite a while, and I'm going to address them because they give me an opportunity to explore something else that's not asked about very often and remains often misunderstood. So it's an opportunity. The words are Atman, or Atma, and Bhavana. And I'm going to use those two words to explain not only the five periods of Buddhist teachings, of Shakyamuni's teachings, but also the concept of nirvana. Because I feel a lot of people take that word for granted and don't fully understand what it means. So Atman and Bhavana. Atman is about this sense we have of an independent, extant self. And then that goes in many directions, or several anyway. For most Westerners, it goes the way of the ideation of a soul. So they take this idea, this ancient idea of a perception of self, and they turn it into this eternal thing that is with us beyond our physical death. How it goes there is rather magical to me. It makes no sense, but the original concept of Atma or Atman is this sense of self, this individuation. And bhavana is related, because bhavana is a word that's not really stands alone, because it tends to be about the instantiation of something, the formation of something. And so you'll see them together as the formation of the identity of self. But that's a big, big clue, and that's why I bring them up together. Because as those terms evolve, and certainly in Shakyamuni's teachings, they are very much nailed down for what they are and used in the earlier teachings. It can be, because there's such a difference, like karma. Karma has a long, long history before Buddhism, but in Buddhism, it's flipped on its head and it's radically changed. And so if you if you pursue the rabbit hole of understanding what karma means without respect to the shift in meaning in Buddhism, you will be misled in understanding what Shakyamuni is talking about in all of Buddhism. So this is why you have to be careful about chasing down words and how they are utilized within the teachings of Buddhism. So Atman and Bhavana predate Buddhism. And so you can go the way of these eternal soul kind of understandings, and that can mix you up entirely in Buddhism, because that's not what Buddhism is about. In fact, it's a refutation of the one and an analysis, a deep analysis of the other. So if you want another deep analysis of that other than my own, you can go back to the first century and Nagarjuna's teachings of the Karika, where he really dissects self and formations. But for today's purposes, I'm going to hopefully try to simplify that. An example I would give for understanding really leads me to the word nirvana. Because I think if you understand the two types of nirvana, what? There are two types? Yeah, there are two types of nirvana. How self and formations relates to nirvana. And they all work together rather nicely, actually. So what is nirvana? So, most of us, not all of us, it depends on your experience in this life, but in some way or another, you've experienced a moment where, how to say this, you've lost track of time, or time didn't exist, or you struggled to figure it out. And if you've ever been in a car accident, or an accident of any sort, really, where there was injury. Generally, whether there was severe injury or not, there will be this moment in retrospect when you say things like, you saw everything in slow motion. Or in another way, you were here and then suddenly you were there and you can't figure out what happened in between. Or you saw someone else in trouble and you just reacted. And in retrospect, you think, yeah, I had no concern for myself, right? We hear in the news, selflessness. There are these moments where we are timeless and we just act without forethought, without thought of self-preservation. Listen to those words, because we hear those words very casually thrown about in our own conversation, in news reports, etc. We hear of feats of intense bravery, and then we talk to the person and they say, well, I just did what I thought I had to do. And it seems to be contradictory, right? And we romanticize all those kinds of stories, all the craziness. But what we're experiencing are moments of awakening. And what we're awakening to is that this stuff of life has nothing to do with life itself. When we respond to help another, for instance, that is our bodhisattva at work. And when we go through bodhisattva to perceive the way, what we call in Buddhism the Buddha way, we simply do with compassion, Buddhist compassion, what needs to be done without consideration of the self. And when we do that and commit to that, time becomes irrelevant. And this is what you hear me constantly repeating about Buddhahood. Awakening, enlightenment, that condition of Buddha is free of the constraints of time. Why is that? Because what we're actually freeing ourselves from are the formations. It's not that they're not there, they don't exist. It's that we're no longer attached to them mentally. They're no longer considerations. Consideration, what is consideration? It is the mental activity of considering. That's where time comes from, instantiation of moments. When we simply awaken to what is needed for the life process, time doesn't matter. It's not a consideration. We simply do, we act. And then when we do that, we are living in that awareness, that Buddha state. We don't call it that unless we're Buddhist, but that's what's happening. And then when it's over, all we can do with our human mind is try to put definitions and identifications around, because that's what we do in samsara. So Buddhism is about non-Atman, an-Atman. Why is it about no self, not self? Because bhavana, because it's not about disappearing the self, it's about addressing the formation of self. So you see how all these ideas in all schools of meditation about stopping thinking and stopping the self, and they're missing the critical point. It's not about stopping thinking or stopping being human or the self. It's about understanding the formation of that and ceasing our attachment to the formation of that, not annihilating it, but understand that the self is not really a thing. Non-self is not about no self. It's about not being attached to the idea of a self, which is an illusion. And the only way you can do that is by understanding the formation of that self and preempting it. When you do that, you're left with Buddhahood, which is a state only experienced through this very samsaric mechanism. Now, if you can hold on to that idea for a minute, you will understand nirvana. Because nirvana is a word simply describing that realization. When you can realize that the moment you are in isn't a moment, or it isn't the formation of the moments, that it is the process from which formations come, then time is irrelevant. And you are experiencing this unattached energy of life. Now, you can't experience that energy of life if you're not in life. So, thusly, there are two nirvanas. There is the nirvana of remainder, what remains, the formations. So there's the nirvana of remainder, which says that you can experience this release and this nirvana without leaving all the formations behind. It's not annihilation. It's not immolation. And then when all of this instantiation, manifestation, this formation of you-ness runs its course and ends its samsaric entity, death, actual death of this life, then that nirvana, as you move toward your cessation of physical reality, that nirvana, that realization of timelessness, which is about to go extinct, is of no remainder, no more formations, no more marrow creating new cells to replace old cells, no more the life process that is instantiating in this physical realm, ergo your brain, your mind, your thinking. It ceases to be. It ceases to continue formations. It no longer forms itself. Now there's no remainder of formations. And that's your final nirvana, your final awakening and understanding of this life force, which now no longer forms. It's done. You are simply melded back into the quiescent energy awaiting to manifest in some other potential. Not you, your life force. No baggage, no self, no soul. All of that are operators for what you're experiencing in the here and now in this life. So this is simply Buddhism. Buddhism takes that experience, which you cannot define, but you all of us at one time or another experience, and puts a microscope to it and lets you know not only how does that work, but how you can get back to it and try to live in that awareness, that selflessness, that compassion, that awe of life itself. So all these terms, Atman, Anatman, Bhavana, formations, Nirvana, Nirvana of remainder, of non-remainder, all of them are talking about this awareness and how do we come to it and how do we end this existence, end the formations ultimately, without going on to the next moment. This is why we talk about the 3,000 realms in a single moment, a thought moment, a moment of life. I think it's more useful to think of it as a thought moment, because that's where we experience life. Without thought, we do not experience life, because experience is a byproduct of formations. When there cease to be formations, there is no thinking. Life exists only as a potential, not an actualization, not a manifestation. Follow? Okay, so that's a short video on Atman, Bhavana, Anatman, Nirvana, words. But understand conceptually what the words are about. That's all. Have a wonderful, pleasant day. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Thank you for being here. See you in the next one.